Well, good morning. It's great to see you all this morning. Several visitors here may not know I've been struggling with COVID for several weeks. I think it's been a month that I've had this stuff, and I've kind of got the long-term gunk still going on. It's been a little bit better day by day. Still interrupting things a little bit, and hope it won't be too difficult in my teaching this morning. I do thank you for your prayers. Thank you for your concerns. Cards and emails and texts just letting us know that you're thinking about us are greatly appreciated, and we do covet your prayers. We believe that it makes a difference what we think about God. We believe that prayer makes a difference because God is, God exists. But it's interesting to note that what a person believes is incredibly significant, even if what they believe in is not necessarily reality. There's a phenomena that has been studied by the medical community kind of called hex death or voodoo death that is typically rejected in the Western world, but it's a somewhat observable phenomena, particularly in third world cultures, where the pattern is kind of the same. There's a person who gets cursed or hexed by a witch doctor or a chief, and then believing that they are going to die, believing that they are completely hopeless and condemned, people tend to actually die within the next day or two. And as researchers have tried to study this, there's a case I was reading about in a medical journal of a Maori woman in New Zealand who ate a piece of fruit only later that day to find out that it was taboo and off limits from the village chieftain. So distressed was she refused any other food or water, and by the next day, she was dead. Certainly far too soon for the lack of food and water just for a few hours to affect her. It wasn't until the Korean War that even Western medicine began to observe this more closely, when prisoners were taken to some of the Chinese labor camps where conditions were harsh, but even healthy young soldiers were subjected to psychological abuse by their communist abductors. And some of them, so distraught and so overwhelmed, would simply resolve that they were going to die. It simply was the case, just accept it. And within 2 to 3 days, young, healthy soldiers were dying without any observable causes. I've had an interesting story this week from the medical journal. It's actually on the website from the National Institute of Health, their National Library of Medicine, about a somewhat famous case of a Mr. Sam Schumann. Sam Schumann was a patient in the 1970s of a Dr. C.K. Meador. Mr. Schumann was diagnosed as having esophageal cancer. So they performed surgery on him, and during that surgery thought they had removed all the cancer, but there were some indications that the cancer had metastasized and it had spread. So they did scans of Mr. Schumann's liver in October and told poor Mr. Schumann that he had only weeks or perhaps a couple of months to live, that the cancer had indeed spread. There was very little they could do about it. Mr. Schumann resolved that he wanted to make it through one more Christmas with his family, and indeed he did. He hung on until Christmas, in fact, until New Year's. When he felt ill, he went back to the hospital, and on January 2nd, he died. But here's the thing. Dr. Meador had some other questionable calls. So an autopsy was performed by Mr. Schumann. It was discovered that his liver was perfectly healthy, as was all of his other internal organs. There was literally no cause of death for Mr. Schumann except the expectation that he was going to die. He was so convinced that death was coming that in some way he psychosomatically induced it, and he did indeed die just after the holidays, which was his only goal in life. I read you these stories, a little bit weird, a little bit interesting, because what we believe matters. How we go through this life matters. Our belief has a sincere and profound effect on us and on our life. And so we've been taking this journey for the last several months looking at the minor prophets. And again, just as we turn to a new of these minor prophets this morning, reminding you that minor did not in any way mean lesser or insignificant, but simply these books are shorter than the major prophets. If you look at Isaiah or Jeremiah, there's 66 chapters or 50-something chapters. So we're looking at those shorter books of the prophets, the 12 that tend to be 3 chapters, 10 chapters maybe at most. So they were labeled as shorter or lesser, and the word has become minor, but not at all insignificant. In fact, this morning, the prophet that we're turning to is one of my absolute favorites, and it's the book of Habakkuk. Habakkuk is a little challenging for me to say with my bells palsy right now. So every time I speak of Habakkuk, it kind of pops out a little bit. But Habakkuk has long been one of my favorite of the minor prophets. I'll let you start turning there now. You may need to go to the index in the front of your Bible to find it. If you're going through some of that collection of, those smaller prophets that are all tucked in there together, it's Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk. Right there before Zephaniah, Haggai, and Zechariah, and Malachi. So about the fifth one from the end of the Old Testament. Just a bit of review of the history and the time that we've been looking at with all of these prophets. For the last several weeks, we were studying, in a sense, the life of King Josiah. Because we found out that King Josiah reigned for a little over 30 years, and during his life, there were a number of prophets that were speaking to him, to the people, to the surrounding countries. So a little bit of review. These are dates and things that we've looked at over the last several weeks, but we found that Josiah's grandfather was King Manasseh, one of the worst of the kings of Judah that had ever lived. And Manasseh had done evil in the sight of the Lord for half a century, more than 50 years he had reigned. He was the one who brought child sacrifice to Jerusalem, made his own sons pass through the fire. In other words, sacrificed some of his own sons, princes of Judah, to the flames, to various pagan gods and deities. The people followed suit. The nobles, the princes, the judges, it says that Jerusalem was as corrupt as ever before. Well, Manasseh's son reigned for just a few years, and then came grandson Josiah. Josiah, becoming king when he was just 8 years old, wanted to reform the nation, wanted to bring the nation back to Yahweh, back to their God. It was he who instituted cleaning out the temple itself in Jerusalem, getting rid of all the idols, all the pagan altars and sacrifices. And so during this time period of 640 to 609, we said he was, in a sense, trying to drain the swamp of Judean culture. These pagan practices and evil ways had become so ingrained during the time of his grandfather Manasseh that even as king, he had great difficulty getting rid of the practices and the beliefs of the people. So, during his reforms, the temple is cleansed. They found the word of God in the temple. The priest, it seemed, almost didn't know what it was that they discovered. It had been so long since anyone had read the books of Moses or the early books of history. They weren't even sure what it was. They brought it out, dusted it off, began to read it, and took it to the king and said, "We think we found something pretty important here." It only spurred Josiah's reforms to continue. And so during those years, we saw that just after Josiah began dedicating himself to the Lord, that God brought the prophet Nahum alongside of him to encourage him. God brought the prophet Zephaniah into the kingdom to direct these reforms and help with him. Jeremiah was actively prophesying during this entire time. Even though God had sent several prophets and had a king who loved and served the Lord, there was very little reform that actually stuck. In 609 BC, we find that King Josiah goes to battle against Pharaoh Necho of Egypt, and he's killed at the Battle of Megiddo. It's worth, if you've already gone to Habakkuk and can put a finger there or your notes or something, or I'm just going to read for you from 2 Kings, sort of the summary of Josiah's life. In 2 Kings 23:25-27. This is what it says about our good King Josiah in 2 Kings 23:25-27. Before Josiah, there was no king like him who turned to the Lord with all of his heart and with all of his soul and with all of his might, according to all the law of Moses. Nor did anyone like him arise after him. However, the Lord did not turn from the fierceness of his great wrath, with which his anger burned against Judah, because all the provocations with which Manasseh had provoked him. And the Lord said, I will still remove Judah from my sight, as I have removed Israel. And I will cast off Jerusalem, this city which I have chosen, and the temple of which I said, my name shall be there. So Josiah was faithful. Josiah tried, it seems like, with all of his might to reform the nation. But the people, the priests, the noble families, refused to follow. And they continued to choose against God. And God says, what you choose to believe matters. And when you reject me and utterly reject me over and over, then discipline comes. So after Josiah is killed in the battle of Megiddo, King Jehoahaz, one of Josiah's sons, takes his place, and he's a wicked ruler. You know, how after 30 years of his dad serving God, the scriptures say, as faithfully as any king ever had before him, he's got a son that decides to do evil in the sight of the Lord and turns against him. The story's in 2 Kings 23. I'll just read again from back there, kind of summarizing what the son's life looks like. 2 Kings 23, 31 to 33. We find out that he's a very weak king. Not only is he evil, but also in verse 31, it says, Jehoahaz was 23 years old when he became king. Just 23. Which means his entire life, he had a father who was dedicated to the Lord. Parents, can I just give a side note to you? You can be faithful. You can be a godly parent who prays, who does everything right, who's faithful and obedient. And you know this, your kids have to make their own choices. And sometimes they choose to rebel against you and against God. That's not a condemnation of you. That's not a judgment against you and all that you've done. Josiah, it says, was one of the most faithful, godly men who'd lived. And yet, his son, 23 years old, when he became king, he reigned 3 months, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord, according to all that his fathers had done. So not his dad, Josiah, but he went back to the old ways of grandpa and great-grandpa and committed great evil. Well, his reign only lasts 3 months until Pharaoh Necho, the one who killed his dad, imprisoned Jehoahaz at Riblah in the land of Hamath so that he could not reign in Jerusalem. And he imposed on the land a fine of 100 talents of silver and 1 talent of gold. So now what we have is Egypt becoming a power, and Egypt taking over even the little country of Judah. Well, the next king from 609 to 597 is a little better. It's a different one of Josiah's sons. The scriptures tell us in the next verse in 2 Kings, Pharaoh Necho made Eliakim, another son of Josiah, king in the place of Josiah his father, and changed Eliakim's name to Jehoiakim. So you see the kind of power that Egypt now has over Jerusalem, choosing who's going to be their king, even renaming him to something that seems more familiar to the Egyptians. Jehoiakim was forced to give silver and gold to the Pharaoh and tax the land in order to give the money at the command of Pharaoh. He exacted silver and gold from the people of the land, each according to valuation, to give it all to Pharaoh Necho. So during this reign of Jehoiakim, he's weak, he's evil, he's a vassal king, a suzerain king that has to serve Egypt. Just a little definition there, if you're not familiar with the word vassal, somebody who's subordinate in position to another. He has to pay homage to the Egyptian kings. And it's during this time, 30 years of reform that really did very little to change the people. And God says, so now my wrath still will come against Jerusalem. We've got a couple of very weak kings, Josiah's children. During this time period, 609 to, well, really early on in this time period, about 607, God raises up another prophet in the land, and that's where we enter the prophet Habakkuk. So we turn this morning to Habakkuk just to introduce the book, look at the first part of the book, and introduce kind of our series of lessons on Habakkuk, which I've chosen to title From Wise to Wise. A little bit of pun in the spelling there. From Wise to Wise. About 607 BC is when Habakkuk is brought before the people. But his book is going to be radically different than the other minor prophets we've looked at. Because each one of the prophets we've looked at so far, we see their words to another country, like Assyria, their words to people who surround Judah, other nations and other oracles, or their words to the king, or their words to the people. In Habakkuk, we don't see his words to the people. In fact, we don't see any of his prophecies that he spoke to the king, or the prophecies that he spoke to the princes, or the nobles, or the people. What we really have in Habakkuk is much more of a personal book. And so chapter one in our sermon today is looking at Habakkuk and finding it's really the personal journal of a wise prophet. The personal journal of a wise prophet. And in the beginning, not wise, W-I-S-E, not a man of great wisdom, but a man who's questioning. A man who's constantly asking, why? 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 And so we turn to Habakkuk chapter 1 this morning and beginning looking at this journal of a wise prophet. And what sense can we make of it? Because what we're really going to see all throughout Habakkuk is just a very personal dialogue between Habakkuk and Yahweh himself. And it's Habakkuk's conversation with God. And so one of the things we'll have to do and discern as we go through these chapters is, when is it Habakkuk talking and when is it God who's speaking? Because the conversation goes back and forth. And if you read it in the original Hebrew, there is very little indication of when things change. You know, the originals were not written with chapter and little verse numbers off to the side. It was simply paragraphs running one into another. And so we've kind of got to get into this mindset that Habakkuk is having a dialogue. There are some indicators in the original text of how this was working, but we're going to kind of work our way through and see that Habakkuk speaks, God answers, Habakkuk speaks, God answers. And it's really this personal journal where Habakkuk kind of describes the process he goes through in his relationship with God. So kind of a unique perspective, a unique look at the prophets this morning. Chapter 1, verse 1 tells us everything we know about the prophet. The oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. What do we know about Habakkuk? He was a prophet. That's it. It's kind of like a certain someone I know who English is not his favorite subject. He might say something like, well, what do you know about To Kill a Mockingbird? Well, it's about mockingbirds and killing them. No. Okay, what do you know about the book To Kill a Mockingbird? It's a book. Okay. What do you know about the author, Miss Lee, who wrote To Kill a Mockingbird? Well, she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. Anything else? It's a book. You know, it's kind of that. It's like, that's about all we have right here. Well, who was Habakkuk? A prophet. What kind of prophet? A prophesying prophet? Where was he from? We don't know. We don't know anything about him. We don't know about his past, his history, his family, any of those things. We've seen in some other books where they give like the lineage and that, oh, he's a descendant of the same King Hezekiah that Josiah is. We don't have any of that here in Habakkuk. We simply have, this is the oracle. This is the vision. These are the words which Habakkuk, the prophet, saw. And so we get into the text in this journal and we see right off a couple of questions. Questions that should humble us. Habakkuk 1, verse 2. How long, O Lord? How long will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to thee, violence, yet you do not save. Why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yes, destruction and violence are before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore, the law is ignored and justice is never upheld. The wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted. And this is how we begin the book of Habakkuk. These are the first words that we see from the prophet. And you can see the whys, the questioning. How long, O Lord? Why do you make me see iniquity? Now we understand his context. We understand why he would cry out this way. 30 years of reforms failed. We've got wicked kings and wicked people and a wicked culture. And that just prompts Habakkuk to say, these are supposed to be your people. We're supposed to look like you, God. How long? How long are you going to let this happen like this? And as I pondered this section, Habakkuk's words here in verses 2, 3, and 4, what's actually going on? It looks to me like there's two questions here that should or could humble us before God. The first question, how long? It's right there in verse 2. How long, Lord? How long will I call for help? Oh, God, how long? This is a question of the heart. And maybe you've been there. God, how long? Oh, recently, how many of us? How long is this COVID thing going to last? How long are my symptoms going to last? How long am I going to deal with this? So our daughter Catherine, several weeks ago, was diagnosed with COVID. Some of you know she's attending Tufts University in Boston, Massachusetts. Pretty strict regulations there when you have COVID. They turned the entire tennis court area of the university into these modular quarantine units. And they actually, I guess, bought these massive modular trailers from fire protection services where guys would go out and fight fires out in the forest and just fight fires all day, just need a place to sleep at night. And they bought these long trailer units and put in there in Boston. So the first time she's diagnosed with COVID, she was sent to the quads. She was sent to that area, from the quad to the mod, I'm sorry, sent to these modular homes where it was just like kind of a dark entryway and then these individual rooms that were very sterile and you just had your little room. It was just like a place to sleep and be quarantined and be away and they kind of check on you and bring food to you. Sounded almost like a prison to her. It felt kind of like a prison. And when they said, oh, you have to go to the mods, you have to quarantine, you know what the first question was? How long do I have to be there? Well, at least 10 days, and then we'll see what happens. How long might I end up staying there? We don't know. Many of you kind of say, how long are we going to deal with this stuff? So remarkably, this last week, after several weeks of being done with COVID, Catherine was sick again, and they said, well, it couldn't be COVID because you just had it. I mean, you're going to kind of be immune to that for a while now. And some other medical people she called said, oh, it's probably, but you should get checked out for the flu. So she went to the doctor and they said, well, it can't be COVID, but let's check you out. I mean, it's campus health services, and let's give you that kind of rapid COVID test, and it'll probably come back negative, and then we'll give you the in-depth one. And they gave her the rapid COVID test. She took it. She did the swab thing, gave it back, said, how long will this take? And the nurse said, oh, it'll take probably 10 to 15 minutes. These take a while to, oh my Lord. I was like, what? She's like, 40 seconds later, she'd already lit up the scale on the COVID test. And the nurse was like, that just doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in less than a minute. And I guess her result was brighter than even the test one that hadn't even showed up yet. They're like, you have it again. What does that mean? Quarantine. How long? How long do I have to go back? All the classes are going to be virtual. All the events have to be virtual now. So she's sent back to quarantine. Fortunately for her, all of the mods are full. They've actually had to rent out a hotel that's nearby. So she's like, what's a little cozier? It's a little nicer than the mod that I was in. So, but the question, how long? How long? Some of you deal with chronic illness. You deal with chronic pain. And some of you have asked, how long is this going to go on? Lord, how long do I have to deal with this? And you don't hear. And you understand what this question is like when Habakkuk is looking at the world, the culture around him, and saying, God, how long? Are you just going to let this go? But something in this question, something behind it, seems to imply we are powerless to stop this. We don't have the power to stop this. If I'm asking God how long, it's just a recognition I can't do anything about this. I personally don't have the power to do anything about this. That's why I said this should be the kind of question that humbles us. When we come before God and recognize, God, I can't do anything here. I'm impotent against this. I have no power against this. The second part, it seems to imply and recognize, we are not in control. He is. Habakkuk doesn't say, okay, God, do I have permission to now go solve this? You're like, hey, God, you just say the word and I'm going to go take it. No, it's Habakkuk saying, how long will you look at this? How long will you allow this? Because Habakkuk is powerless to stop it. Habakkuk realizes he is not in control. God is. I kind of made that a capital H in this font. You can't see that real well, so I'll point that out. When we ask this, oh God, how long, it implies that I'm not in control. He is. So that's Habakkuk's first question. Then we come to the second question, just straight out, why? Why? Why do you make me look on iniquity? Why do you cause me to see all of this wickedness? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arises. Why? God, why is this going on? And implicit in this question seems to be, first of all, Habakkuk doesn't have a clear assessment of things. And when we ask God why, the reality is we don't have a clear assessment of what's going on. That's why we're asking why. And that's because we don't have adequate knowledge or wisdom. When I'm forced to ask God why are we dealing with this? Why is this still happening? Perhaps when you have asked the question, why this diagnosis? Why do we have to go through this? Why is this happening to us again? And you ask that in your heart. It's a humbling recognition that we don't have a clear assessment of things. We don't have adequate knowledge or wisdom. And the reality is, we like to be in control. We like to know what's going on. We like to have an idea and a sense and a clear assessment of what's happening so that, I mean, think about this. Is it just that you want to really know what's going on and assess clearly what's going on right at this moment? No, typically, and I think what Habakkuk is saying, if I just understood right now, then I would know what's coming next. Then I would know what to do about it. And so often, when we ask these questions, how long and why, we really want to know what's coming next. What do I do next? As though we would have some more security if we knew the future, some sense of being able to control what's coming next. In 2011, our family got to spend an extended time down outside of San Antonio, Texas, working at a camp during the summer. It's really neat Christian ministry. We're just able to volunteer down there for several weeks. And on the weekends, we wanted to go to church somewhere and found out that Max Lucado's church is very nearby, within a half hour where we're staying. And if you have read any of the books by Max Lucado or things, you're like, he's just a phenomenal speaker, and our kids were young, and they were into the Hermy and Wormy videos. Does anybody know those? Do you guys Hermy and Wormy? Those were produced by Max Lucado in the church there. So we were privileged on Sundays to go visit his church for several weeks, just at Oak Hills, right down the highway from where we were. And one of the Sundays we were there, Max Lucado was talking about wanting to be in control and his desire to kind of control things and know what's happening and know what's coming. And he gave the illustration of a time when he and his wife had to travel several hours. They were going to pick up a new puppy, a new little dog that was they were welcoming into their family. And so Max is driving, the wife's next to him. She puts the info into the GPS, and he's like, all right, what's the route? And she said, turn left out of the driveway. He's like, no, what's the route that we're taking? Where is this exactly? You set this up, how are we getting there? She goes, I'll let you know before you need to turn what's coming next. Turn left going out of the driveway. He's like, really? So he turns left. He's like, all right, which road are we going to? She's like, I'll let you know in time before you need to turn next. I'm only going to give you the directions one at a time. He said he was so frustrated with her that she decided this was going to be kind of this game that she was going to play that day and make. But it brought to his mind the reality of how frustrated he was when he's not in control and he doesn't know what's coming next. And I just sat there listening to this illustration going, I feel you, buddy. I get it. I want to know what's next so I can prepare for it. I want to know what's coming. And when I don't know, when I can't assess what's going on now, and I don't have the knowledge and discernment to see what's actually happening in front of me, then I know I can't control what's coming next. We want to, don't we? We want to control it. We want to know. We want to plan for it. We want to somehow just be prepared for all the possibilities. A lot of our life is like that. Our jobs are like that. Our schooling is like that. You got to know the steps. You got to know what's next. You got to have a plan. It's all covers several years and what's coming, what the vision is and what the structure is going to be and what we're going to do about it. And then, you know, you don't have to watch TV very long before those financial commercials pop up with a little green arrow on the sidewalk, what you should do next and how much do you need for retirement. And they pop up these numbers and you're like, I haven't made that much in my entire life. I'm supposed to have saved that much? How's that supposed to happen? And you're like, but that's why. Because we want to control the future. We want to know what's coming. But listen, the scriptures say plenty about planning wisely for the future. But what this is a condition of the heart that wants to know and wants to control. This is not talking about planning wisely and having discernment. This is God, what are you doing? Why are you doing it this way? Why is this going on? And these questions can and should humble us. And when you ask those questions of the heart, it should come from a humble heart that's really saying, God, you're in control. I'm not. God, you have all the power here. I don't have any. That's a humble position that God honors. We're going to find out in chapter 2, God does not want our pride. God considers our pride to be a serious condition of the soul. God's looking for a humble and a contrite heart. And so these two questions Habakkuk could have been asking out of humility and could have been asking from that humble spirit. But instead, we find out Habakkuk's got a little bit to learn because it's not just the questions. The questions are followed by two accusations against God. And these accusations show Habakkuk's arrogance. And when we ask the same kind of questions or make the same kind of accusations, it shows our arrogance. Did you notice them back in verses 2 and 3? When he says, oh, how long, O Lord, will I call for help? But then comes the accusation, you don't hear. And you will not hear. I cry out to thee violence, and you don't save. Now, this is serious stuff when you've got a prophet who's making accusations against God. Because the first thing he says to God is, you don't hear. Oh, I've been crying out, how long? Because you don't hear. Well, what's going on here? I think this implies either God, you don't know what's happening, or God, you don't care what's happening. And see, this is kind of taking that humble questioning of, oh, how long, oh Lord? God, you're in control, you have a how long, oh Lord? And this takes it to, God, you're not doing this right. God, you either don't know what's happening, or God, you don't care what's happening. And those go from questioning and humility to accusing God. In fact, it seems to me to kind of be putting ourselves in the role of the one who gets to determine what's right, putting ourselves in the role of knowing what's right and wrong. And God, you're not doing this right. God, you don't hear. You don't know what's going on, or you don't care what's happening down here. We're going to see this continue to grow in Habakkuk's second question when he says, you don't save. What's he really saying there? He's saying, God, either you are unwilling to help, or you are unable to help. I mean, what other alternatives are there? When you come before God and you say, you don't hear. Isaiah chapter 40 has some of our favorite verses in all of the Old Testament. Because at the end of Isaiah 40, we get those great verses about those who wait for the Lord gain new strength. They will walk and not be weary. They will run and not faint. They will mount up with wings like eagles. So those are great verses. But it's just four verses before that that we see the heart of Israel at that time in Isaiah's day. And it's very similar to what we see in Habakkuk. Isaiah chapter 40, verse 27, I'll read to you. Why do you say, O Jacob, how can you assert, O Israel, my way is hidden from the Lord, and the justice due me escapes the notice of my God? Do you see the same two accusations there? The same two accusations against God in Isaiah's day. First, they were saying, my way is hidden from the Lord. In other words, you don't see. You don't even know what's happening. Our way is hidden from you. You don't realize what's going on, God. Come on, get a clue. Now, we would like to think we would never talk that way to God. Habakkuk is, and I think sometimes we do too. You don't hear. Our way is hidden from you. You don't understand what's going on. God, you don't know what it's like down here. And the second part, the justice due me escapes the notice of God. In other words, God, you're not doing this the right way. God, you're not doing what you ought to do. This is wrong. Now, again, it's not very often that we would say and we would admit, I think God's wrong. I think God messed up. It's like, oh, that's a little harsh, Dan. We don't go there. But when we go from that humble questioning to making accusations, that's exactly what we're doing. And you know, we're kind of in good company there too. I was reminded of the instance in the book of Mark, as I thought through this, like, would somebody just tell God he doesn't care? He doesn't know what he's doing? Mark chapter 4 tells us a story when Christ was on the earth and his disciples were with him and they'd all gotten into a boat. And it says in Mark chapter 4, verse 36, leaving a multitude behind, they took Jesus along with them, just as he was, and he went into the boat. And there were other boats with them. So there's a group of boats now. 37, they went out on the sea, and there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much the boat was filling up with water. And Jesus was in the stern asleep. So he's in the back of the boat. He's had a long day teaching. He's just taking a nap. He was asleep on a cushion. And the disciples woke him up and said to him, Teacher, don't you care that we're all perishing? Don't you care? Don't you see what's going on? Don't you know what's happening here? Do you not care? And being roused, Jesus rebuked the wind and said to the sea, Hush, be still. The wind died down. It became perfectly calm. But then he said to the disciples, look at how Jesus interpreted the situation. Why are you so timid? That's really the word for cowardly fear. It's a little more than just shy. Why are you so cowardly fearful? How is it that you have no faith? When I look at Habakkuk and I look at his words, I see two questions that could and should humble us before God, recognize his place and kind of recognize ours, that we're not him. But when he moves into accusing God of not knowing what's going on, not hearing, or choosing not to save, or being unable to save, he puts himself in the position of being able to judge God as though he has some right to now judge what God is doing. That's a position that we ought not to put ourselves in. I think we do it a lot more than we like to recognize. In this world, we know things aren't right. But if we read the book and go back to Genesis 3, we'll recognize, no, things aren't right. sin entered the world, and death by sin. And so death has passed upon all men. It happened in Genesis 3. We read about it in Romans. Our scripture reading this morning from Romans 1. Why did Jesus have to come? Why did we need the gospel? Because this world had turned to sin, and it was fallen, and it was broken, and people had turned to worshiping just about anything except for God himself. That's exactly what was going on in Habakkuk's day, and it's what's going on in our day. We look around this world, things are not as they should be. Because people were intended to live in this beautiful, perfect garden, and they were driven out of it because of sin, which means this life isn't right. This world isn't right. Things are not going to be as they should be. And they're never going to be what they ought to be down here until Jesus comes again and brings a new heaven and a new earth, just wipes everything out and starts all over in a sense. Until that day, things aren't going to be right down here. They're not going to go well. They're not going to look right. And so the question for us is, how are we going to respond when that happens? How are we going to respond when that happens and life begins caving in? That's where Habakkuk's at. Habakkuk's at a point of saying, God, how could, I mean, Josiah has only been gone 2 years. Look at his sons. Look what's happening. I mean, we've gone right back to the way things were, the horrible history we had. God, how long? Why? How come you're not doing anything about this? This isn't right. You're not doing what's right. You don't care or you're powerless. I don't know, but this isn't right. Habakkuk is figuring out how to respond when the world isn't right. And we have to choose how we're going to respond when the world isn't right. And over the next couple of weeks, we're going to see kind of the journey that Habakkuk goes on. Because later in chapter 1, things get worse. Not does the culture get worse, Habakkuk's response gets worse. He's actually, we're going to see next week, puts himself in a position to judge God and say to God, you're wrong, go back and change your mind, I'll wait here. Literally. Like, well, I would never. Well, I have. And Habakkuk did. This morning, our application is going to look at, in this world of never-ending injustice, where there is pain and where there is very real suffering, and it is often very personal, and it's caused by the broken, fallen state of humanity, do we choose humility or arrogance? I had opportunity to talk to some people this week. One guy who's really struggling with some things going on in his church. He's really struggling with how it's being done. And his desire is to go kind of flame everybody, just to go, you're wrong, and you're wrong, and you're wrong, and none of this is right, and you know it's wrong, and you ought to change it, and we shouldn't put it, and he just wants to angrily go and just pass judgment on everybody and burn the place down, as it were. And I gave him this challenge. How are you going to respond to this? With arrogance or with humility? Listen, I get your situation. I hear what you're saying. This is a real thing that's going on, and it's hard. And after listening to him, I'm like, it's not right, and I'm sorry. What they're doing is not right. The way you're being treated and the way people are accusing you of things and the way that they're kind of starting to form a group against you to push you out, it's not right, and it shouldn't be happening. But are you going to respond in arrogance or humility? Because I know when God gave a list of the 6 things that he hates, very top of the list was pride. The very first thing. When God says, there are 6 things I hate, 7 are abomination to me, and the very first thing he addresses is pride. And the very first thing he's going to address with Habakkuk is pride. When the heart aches, when life is difficult, do we choose humility or arrogance? Because God is looking for a humble and contrite heart. Because the reality is, we're choosing our God And what we believe matters and will affect how we live our life. Either our God is going to be ourself, because he doesn't know what he's doing and he doesn't care, or he's unable or he's unwilling and he's not doing it the right way. That's choosing me. If I'm going to accuse God, if I'm going to go that far to say God's not doing it right, I'm like, well, then I must be smarter than God. Which is the problem of Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve wanted to be smarter than God, or at least as smart as God, and know as much as God knew about things. It's that same sin that's been there ever since. So who are you going to choose as your God? Yourself? Or the all-powerful, all-knowing creator who gave himself for you, the one who's ever present, the one who's ever available, and wants to take control of all that you humbly yield to him, and in exchange, Philippians 4 tells us, can give you a peace that does not need to know, and a peace that does not need to control. It's a peace that surpasses all understanding and all human discernment and all human knowledge. Habakkuk presents us with this really tough challenge from his own personal experience, and I'm glad God said, write it down, circle it, highlight it, underline it. That's good Bible, print it. Because we face the same things, we ask the same questions, but how far will we go? Past humility and into pride, choosing ourselves to be God or relying on him. It's a choice we get to make every day. It's a choice we need to make wisely. Let's pray. Father God, you are the immortal, invisible, only wise God. But we are so tempted day in and day out, situation by situation, to put ourselves in that role. We want to be in control. We want to know. We want to be able to assess. We want to be able to decide, to choose for ourselves, to control the future. God, teach us humility. Humble us under your great and mighty hand, just as you had to humble Habakkuk. I pray that you would sustain us in our difficulty, that you would show us your care, your concern, your power, but God, that you would always bring us to that point of humility and accepting and trusting even when we don't see and even when we don't know, that we would be willing to say, have your own way, Lord. Have your own way. Amen. And so as a response this morning, we're going to sing a wonderful